welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, we begin with Ask a Teacher. Dr. Jill Robbins will answer a language question from one of our listeners. Then sit back and relax with American Stories. Today you will hear the end of the four-part story, Blue Hotel. We will hear from Dr. Jill again with a story about plague in art. Mario Ritter reports about a certain type of tree called a mangrove. And our broadcast will end with Pete Musto. He reports on the delay of production of hand sanitizer. But first, here is Dr. Jill with Ask a Teacher.
This week, we answer a question from Viola in China, who writes, I'm following your program all the time, and I love it so much. I desperately want to learn about the meaning of the word ever, especially the differences between ever and never. Thanks very much. Viola, China. Dear Viola, thanks for following our program. There are some simple rules that may help you learn how to use the words ever and never. Ever is an adverb, so it affects the meaning of a verb. The simple meaning of ever is at least once. It can also mean at all times. Language experts tell us that ever only belongs in sentences with some negative quality. For example, she didn't ever call back means the same as she did not call at all times. You will see ever in questions. The question, have you ever seen the northern lights? Means the same as, have you seen the northern lights at least once? Where is the negative in that question? Grammar experts say that when you ask a question, there may be a negative answer. So ever is used in this kind of question. Ever can also express a doubt, as in, if you ever see that man again, ask his name. The speaker here is unsure about whether the listener will see the man again. On the other hand, never already has a negative idea, so it belongs in sentences without any negative. Never is also an adverb, and it means not ever or not at any time. I have never seen such a beautiful sky. Another difference is that you can use never as a one-word answer, while you cannot do so with ever. For example, you copied my work. Me? Never. And that's Ask a Teacher for this week. I hope you never stop asking questions. I'm Jill Robbins.
The Blue Hotel, Part 4.
The Swede's face, fresh from Johnny's blows, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the whipping snow. A number of square shapes appeared before him, and he recognized them as the houses of the town. He traveled along a street until he found a saloon. He pushed open the door and entered. At the end of the room, four men sat drinking at a table. The Swede dropped his bag upon the floor and smiling at the saloon keeper, said,
"Give me some whiskey, will you?"
The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of ice-filled water upon a table. The Swede poured himself an extra large amount of whiskey and drank it down.
"Bad night,"
remarked the saloon keeper without interest. He was acting as though he were not noticing the man, but it could have been seen that he was secretly studying the remains of blood on the Swede's face.
"Bad night,"
he said again.
"Oh, it's good enough for me,"
replied the Swede as he poured himself some more whiskey.
"No,"
continued the Swede,
"this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me."
The large drinks of whiskey made the Swede's eyes watery, and he breathed a little heavier.
"Well, I guess I'll take another drink,"
said the Swede after a while.
"Would you like something?"
"No, thanks. I'm not drinking. How did you hurt your face?"
The Swede immediately began to talk loudly.
"Oh, in a fight. I beat the soul out of a man at Scully's Hotel."
This caught the interest of the four men at the table.
"Who was it?"
asked one.
"Johnny Scully, son of the man who owns the hotel. He will be nearly dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I beat him well, I did. He couldn't get up. They had to carry him into the house. Have a drink."
Instantly, the men, in a quiet way, surrounded themselves in privacy.
"No, thanks,"
said one. It was a strange group. Two were well-known local businessmen. One was a lawyer, and one was a gambler. But a close look at the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the other men. He was, in fact, so delicate in manner and so careful with whom he gambled that the men of the town completely trusted and admired him. His business was regarded with fear and lack of respect. That is why, without doubt, his quiet dignity shone brightly above the quiet dignity of men who might be merely hat makers or builders or salesmen. Beyond an occasional unwise traveler who came by rail, this gambler supposedly cheated only careless farmers who, when rich with good crops, drove into town full of foolish pride. Hearing at times of such a farmer, the important men of Romper usually laughed at his losses. And if they thought of the gambler at all, it was with a kind of pride of knowing he would never dare to attack their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was known that this gambler had a wife and two children in a nice little house where he led a perfect home life. And when anyone even suggested that there was a fault in his character, the men immediately described the virtues of his family life. And one must not forget to declare the bare fact of his entire position in Romper. It is true that in all affairs other than his business, this card player was so generous, so fair, so good, that he could be considered to have a higher moral sense than 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with two local businessmen and the lawyer. The Swede continued to drink whiskey and to try to make the saloon keeper drink with him.
"Come on. Have a drink. Come on. No? Well, have a little one then. By God, I've beaten a man tonight. And I beat him good, too. Gentlemen,"
the Swede cried to the men at the table,
"have a drink."
"Shh, quiet,"
said the saloon keeper. The group at the table although really interested, had been trying to appear busy and talk. But now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly,
"Thanks. We don't want any more."
At this reply, the Swede straightened.
"Well,"
he shouted,
"it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me. I want someone to drink with me now. Now! Do you understand?"
He struck the table with his hand. Years of experience had hardened the saloon keeper. He merely answered,
"I hear you."
"Well,"
cried the Swede,
"listen then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch."
"Stop that,"
shouted the saloon keeper.
"Why should I?"
demanded the Swede. He walked to the men's table and by chance laid his hand on the shoulder of the gambler.
"What about it?"
he asked angrily.
"I asked you to drink with me."
The gambler simply turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
"My friend, I don't know you."
"Never mind,"
answered the Swede.
"Come and have a drink."
"Now, my boy,"
advised the gambler kindly,
"take your hand off my shoulder and go away."
He was a little, thin man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone to the big Swede. The other men at the table said nothing.
"What? You won't drink with me, you little fool? I'll make you then. I'll make you."
The Swede had grasped the gambler fiercely at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men jumped up. The saloon keeper ran toward the table. There was a great scene of shouts and movements, and then a long knife appeared in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body was cut as easily as if it had been a piece of fruit. The Swede fell with a cry of greatest surprise. The businessman and the lawyer must have rushed out of the place backward. The saloon keeper found himself hanging weakly to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer.
"Henry,"
said the latter,
"you tell them where to find me. I'll be home waiting."
Then he left. A moment afterward, the saloon keeper was in the street, racing through the storm for help and, more important, companionship. Months later, the cowboy was cooking meat on the stove of a small cattle farm near the Dakota border when there was the sound of a horse stopping outside. The Easterner entered with mail and newspapers.
"Well,"
said the Easterner at once,
"the fellow who killed the Swede will spend 3 years in prison. That's not much, is it?"
"He will? 3 years?"
The cowboy turned the meat in the pan.
"3 years? That isn't much."
"No,"
replied the Easterner.
"There was a lot of sympathy for him in Romper."
"If the saloon keeper had been any good,"
said the cowboy thoughtfully,
"he would have gone in and hit that Swede on the head with a bottle in the beginning of it. That would have stopped all this murdering."
"Yes, 1,000 things might have happened,"
said the Easterner sharply. The cowboy moved his pan of meat on the fire, continued with his philosophy.
"It's strange, isn't it? If he hadn't said Johnny was cheating, he'd be alive this minute. He was an awful fool. I believe he was crazy. I feel sorry for that gambler,"
said the Easterner.
"So do I,"
said the cowboy.
"He doesn't deserve 3 years in prison for killing that fellow. The Swede might not have been killed if everything had been honest. might not have been killed,
exclaimed the cowboy.
Everything honest. When he said that Johnny was cheating and acted so crazy, and then in the saloon he practically asked to get hurt?
With these arguments, the cowboy made the Easterner angry.
You're a fool,
cried the Easterner fiercely.
You're a bigger fool than that Swede. Now let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. Listen, Johnny was cheating. Johnny,
said the cowboy blankly. There was a minute of silence, and then he said strongly,
Oh no, the game was only for fun. Fun or not,
said the Easterner.
Johnny was cheating. I saw him. I know it. I saw him. And I refused to stand up and be a man. I let the Swede fight alone, and you were simply jumping around the place and wanting to fight. And old Scully, too. We are all in it. This poor gambler just got pulled into it. Every sin is the result of shared effort. We, five of us, have shared in the murder of this Swede. You, I, Johnny, old Scully, and that fool of an unfortunate gambler came merely at the end of a human movement and gets all the punishment.
The cowboy, hurt and angry, cried out blindly into this mystery of thought.
Well, I didn't do anything, did I?
And now, here again is Dr. Jill.
Lauren Bucus is a writer who likes to tell stories about power between men and women. Her new book, Afterland, will tell the story of a disease that kills almost the entire male population. I wanted to explore what a world without men would look like, and how it wouldn't necessarily be a better place, says Bucus. She began her book years before the coronavirus outbreak. Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. He says he got the idea for his new book from the filmmaker Ridley Scott. Scott asked him years ago after reading Cormac McCarthy's dystopian The Road, how could social order break down so much after a disaster? His upcoming novel, The End of October, describes an international outbreak that begins in Asia. He says people have become so worried about terrorism that they have forgotten the power of natural disasters. Plagues have been with us for at least as long as people have been able to write about them. But among artists and writers, their meaning has changed a lot based on the writer and the period. Once an outbreak was believed to be a punishment from God. People were punished for sinning in some way. However, outbreaks also allow us to see that there is good and bad in all humans. For the Greek historian Thucydides, the plague that nearly destroyed Athens proved to him that praying made little difference, and men could easily break the law or become violent during a crisis. Edgar Allan Poe showed the arrogance of trying to defy disease in The Mask of the Red Death. Steven Soderbergh made the movie Contagion about 10 years ago, to show how easily society can come apart. Many artists found a voice painting the Black Plague of the Middle Ages. They showed frightening deaths as well as images of Saint Sebastian and Saint Roch, whose presences were meant to comfort the families of the dead. Saint Sebastian had survived being shot with arrows, and St. Roch was believed to have survived the plague. So you often see them appearing in art, says C. Griffith Mann. He is head of the Department of Medieval Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Also during the Middle Ages, the writer Boccaccio wrote the Decameron that describes how young women and young men flee from the plague. Alone in a great house, they tell each other stories to pass the time. Boccaccio knew what we could do in the time of the plague. We need to escape from our real world, says Wayne A. Reburn. He is the head of the English department at the University of Texas at Austin. If the plague shows just how desperate and fragile human life can be, stories offer a way to cope with that desperation, he says. I'm Jill Robbins.
Disappearing natural resources like mangrove forests are important to reduce flooding in low-lying coastal areas like southern Florida, scientists say. Mangrove trees grow in coastal wetlands. Unlike other trees, they can grow in salty seawater. Their roots form a dense barrier that helps prevent erosion and controls the force of incoming water from tides and ocean storms. Scientific studies do not agree on how high tides and rising seas linked to climate change will affect Florida. However, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, or NOAA, predicts that the sea level could rise by as much as 2 meters by the year 2100. If that happens, large areas of Florida would be underwater. Environmental scientist Margarita Krupp is trying to develop ways to limit the damage from flooding and rising seas. She said, "We're trying to project how fast we're expecting them to rise so we can plan how we're going to protect our communities for the future." Laura Gesselbracht is a marine scientist in Florida. She works for the environmental group Nature Conservancy. She says mangrove forests like the ones in Olita River State Park near Miami Beach provide protection against flooding. Even though this area is surrounded by a lot of high development, the mangroves will help reduce flooding, she said. But Florida's mangrove forests face threats from building and other kinds of projects. Most of our mangroves have been eliminated for development. As sea level rises, some areas will no longer be habitable, and maybe some homes and other structures will be removed, Gesselbracht said. Environmental scientist Margarita Krupp warns of flooding in coastal areas in places like Miami Beach. That is because, she says, there is porous rock underground that leaks water. On the roads, it means water could be coming up our drainage systems, Krupp said. Another influence on water levels in low-lying coastal communities is the seasonal king tides. These are very high tides that affect groundwater levels. Water may be coming up over seawalls for our residents, causing flooding in their homes and backyards, she said. Flooding linked to rising seas is being reported in many parts of the world. In southern Florida, high tides are threatening drinking water and causing soil erosion. Mangrove forests on the coast are natural resources that can help prevent both erosion and floods. We recognize that bringing back mangroves is going to help us be better protected in the future, she said. Krupp has advice for people in coastal areas around the world where mangrove forests live. In areas that are underdeveloped, see how you can preserve nature rather than trying to bring it in once you've developed these areas. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Americans are finding themselves with a never-before-seen shortage of paper and cleaning products such as disinfectants and hand sanitizers. Traditional cleaning products simply cannot be found at supermarkets across the country. Washing hands with soap and using household cleaning products may help with personal protection against the coronavirus. Americans often turn to disinfectant liquid or wipes for use outside the home, in vehicles, and public spaces. But there appears to be little chance of sanitizers returning to stores in large enough amounts to be useful. VOA spoke with a leading U.S. manufacturer of health and personal cleaning products to explain the shortage. The demand for hand sanitizers was never expected by anyone in the industry, and for that reason, none of the players in the market were prepared, notes Rakesh Tamabatala. He serves as chief executive officer of QYK Brands. He told VOA that the unexpectedly high demand has caused severe shortages of some raw, unprocessed materials like pure alcohol. Now there is not enough to meet the increased demand. The increasing demands have caused the prices of alcohol and other ingredients to go up about 200%, Tamabachala said. He added that the timelines of production have been extended to 6 to 8 weeks. The shortage of normal ingredients for sanitizers has led to searches for substitute ingredients. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently eased its rules to let manufacturers use ethanol alcohol for hand sanitizers during the shortage. Some distilleries have turned to producing sanitizers from their own alcohol to help fight the shortage. Some people are creating their own sanitizers with oils or lemons, but there is no evidence they work. Experts advise against homemade sanitizers, saying these products could be harmful or useless. A real sanitizer should have at least 60% alcohol, they note. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has the best advice. Wash your hands with soap and hot water as often as possible. I'm Pete Musto.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo. Thanks for listening.
This is V.